How many of y'all got that grandmama that can take sunflower seeds and turn it into a turkey? So we're sitting at the table. It's me, my sister, my mom, my grandmother, my grandfather, my two aunts sitting across the table, and there's a spot open, and I'm sitting there, I'm eating, and all of a sudden I stopped and I looked up and I looked around and I said, where's my dad?
Welcome, welcome. This is Sharon Smith here, and this is I Am Big Podcast, and I am here with the author, motivational speaker, and poet himself, and a coach. I found out he's also a coach. I'll tell you more about that coach stuff. I'd like to give you Arik Jackson.
What's up? Hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo. That's my old school Chicago. I know, right?
And since he's from Chicago, that's a Michael Jordan Bulls fan himself.
You know it. I was there when it all happened.
Oh, snap, Jackson.
I was there when the Bears did the Super Bowl shuffle, man. That was like 1986.
Uh-oh.
I don't even think I was 10 or 11.
The 80s,
but
baby.
I knew that whole... Let's not know. Believe it or not, I'm a 70s baby who lived like an 80s baby.
76.
1976. July 4th, 1976. So I'm like a bicentennial baby.
Oh, December 5th.
No. Did I say December?
I'm December 5th. You said July.
July.
Yeah.
Oh, December 5th. July 4th.
Yeah. I'm just, you 4th of July baby.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Like bicentennial.
Okay.
Like, and like literally my family, my mom was having me, she went into labor, I guess, the beginning of the month. And my family is very huge on celebrating like 4th of July, like ribs and all that fun stuff. And they were like, yeah, we're coming to see you after we're done with the ribs and potato salad because this is on the 4th of July. You're not going to mess it up for us. So that's why I feel so welcome by my family. God. Yeah. God. Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Now I can see why. It's like every 4th of July is already a happy birthday for you, huh?
You know, we'll say that. My uncles had me believing that until I got in middle school, and the middle school kids were like, those fireworks are not for you. I've never been so devastated in my life. Like, middle school kids can be mean, man. Like, I'm surprised I didn't go to jail back then. Like,
The way they do it now is like, please come. Like,
bruh, I would survive middle school right now. Like, mm-mm.
So since you are from Chicago, and there's a lot of people coming out of Chicago these days, you got beyond just Kanye West and beyond a lot of the rappers and stuff. I mean, even the president came from Chicago.
Yeah,
former president came from Chicago. I mean, Chicago got a lot of people that need to be heard. Midwest, I don't know.
It's in the water. It's in the water. Lake Michigan water. No, it's very amazing. And just being from Chicago, and like you have the Kanyes and things like that. And I almost feel a responsibility to represent when I say that I'm from Chicago, especially the South Side of Chicago.
Oh,
like, you know, the South Side can be, you know, it amazes me when I talk to people across the globe and they're like, oh, you're in Chicago, it's so dangerous. And I'm like, man, it's just so amazing to me how media has just really twisted it. Like, they make it seem like when you, make it seem like when you get off the plane, somebody gonna shank you. Like, it's, and that's not the case. But like any other city, like, of course, there's great areas and there's bad areas. You know, you not used to, you know, hanging with the hood people, don't go to K-Town in Chicago. But, you know, but K-Town is also one of the most influential areas when it comes to like the art and I guess it would be considered tagging and all. Like, if you go through there, like some beautiful art, even some sculpture art, not too far from the United Center, which is funny because the United Center, where the Bulls repped, West Side of Chicago. So it's I feel a responsibility to represent my home. I'm proud of my home. I love Chicago. The only reason why I don't live there now is because the weather, the winters are just straight up disrespectful. Like, they, you know, they disrespectful, and I need warmth. Yeah, that's the best way I could put it.
Most
yeah.
definitely. And speaking of which, we know like one of the senior veteran poets out there is Kevin Koval.
Mm-hmm.
He basically wrote a lot of books and stuff about Chicago. He reps it to the T and stuff, mm-hmm. and is a slammer.
Yeah.
But also, I was going to say that being that poetry, you got a lot of poets out there, and also a lot of, there's a lot of history in Chicago that still is prevalent now.
Yeah.
Even the vision and also the way things have been said and stuff. But how... talk about your story. Let's talk about what made you come out of Chicago to here. What started Arik?
So, I grew up in a very proud family, and the best way that I can explain that, so my great-grandfather, Dr. A.F. Gage, was a pastor. He also oversaw one of the very first community choirs in Chicago, which was a huge thing back then, but also he was the first African-American print shop owner in Chicago, period. Like, if you go to Chicago's Museum of Science and Industry, his print press is actually in there.
Oh, dope.
So my family has always had this thing of, we're proud. This is who we are. This is the blood that we come from. And I think it's a beautiful thing. And the thing that was very interesting for my journey is I had to figure a lot of it out on my own, in the sense that I was the first child to both my mom and dad. I was the first grandchild to both sides of the family. So technically, I'm the first of my generation, which is just, you know, so I had nobody to look up to. And I had cousins and I had uncles and stuff like that. But I knew growing up, I was different in the sense that, you know, yeah, I could watch basketball, football, but that just wasn't my thing. I was more attracted to the arts, and I attributed a lot of that to my mom. Like, she would literally sit me in front of a TV and I would watch like ballroom dancing and stuff like that. So it really sparked my interest in the arts. And so going through church, like I was a church boy, just right. Straight up, for like 20 something years. My mom was the minister of music, so she was all about music. She passed that mantle to me, and I took it begrudgingly, because I was like, I don't want to do what you do. Like, people don't like you, but you make them sing. Like, no, because you know, I'm just gonna say, I don't know who's listening, but you know, black folks, when it comes to certain things, they could be like, I ain't doing that, you know. But so the thing was, is my mom exposed me to so much culture that really started to catch my attention. And how I started to use that was, as I went through school, I got very involved in like theater and drama and all of that. And it caught my eye so much. And I found this escape. My grandmother, love her to life. That's my G. That's my girl. And she's the matriarch of the family. Like, she is the... If you don't do it her way, you might as well just sign your papers off from this family, because she's like, you're not going to be a part of it anymore, you know? And so, you know, her and I growing up, because I was trying to find myself, her and I would often end up at odds with each other, and I grew up in her house.
Okay.
And one day I just stepped away and I just started writing, just like randomly writing.
Hmm.
And I don't know what drove me to that, but I was like, huh. And actually, I started writing out characters and different things like that. Like, I write these scenes between people, you okay. know. And it was just this weird thing that just kind of naturally arose. And even when I look at when I was younger, like my Legos, you can ask my sister to this day, my Legos, I would take them, and instead of trying to build like a robot or something like that, I would build a stage. And I would take pennies, and those would be the actors on the stage. So it was very interesting. So I got into writing. And actually, at the age of 14, you know, my grandmother, she saw that talent. She was like, yeah, you should really do this. At the age of 14, I wrote my very first stage play.
Okay.
And it was called Time Out for Playing Church. So, of course, it was for the church. But 14-year-old directed it, produced it. I didn't even know what producing was back then. And got into that whole thing, and that really sparked something in me. And I did playwriting, and it was good, but then I got exposed to the poetry scene in Chicago.
Okay.
A couple of my buddies, like, they were like, come check this out. And it would be like open mics and stuff like that. And it was just something about listening to, it was great. Like, I love Dr. Seuss, you know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
But you could like read Dr. Seuss and you can speak Dr. Seuss, right. You know? And so for me, it was like seeing these different people take these words and just put such heart and such drive behind it. I was like, man, like, I really like that. So then my writing shifted from playwriting to poetry, like playing with that. Like, I went out, got a rhyming dictionary. I thought everything needed to rhyme and everything had to have the same. But I started, I got really heavy into writing poetry, and I would like write poetry for different family members. Like, hey, here, instead of a birthday card, you know, here's a poem. And I did that a lot, even for my grandmother. And to this day, she still has poems that I wrote when I was like, you know, 15, 16, 17 years old, you know? So got into it. At the age of 18, I met somebody who I thought was going to be forever. We ain't even going to go there right now. And we were in a relationship for about 6 years. And I was like at the height of writing my poetry and this and all there. And it got to a point where my partner at the time, he was like, why you spend so much time writing poetry? And I'm like, because I like it.
Right.
Well, you need to be spending more time with me. And it got to a point where me writing poetry or taking time to like invest in that became a contention in our relationship.
Right.
So I slowly but surely put the poetry down. And about 3 years into it, I stopped writing poetry, like period, like done. And needless to say, that relationship didn't last. I'm surprised it lasted another 3 years. Damn. But at the end of it, my boy Keith, he was like, bro, like, I know you got some good stuff for some poetry, bro. Man, I can't wait to hear it. And I was like, bro, like, I haven't written poetry for like 3 years. And he like paused. Yeah. And there was like this uncomfortable silence. And he then went off on me. He was like, don't you ever let somebody take something that you love from you. That's who you are. That's the core of who you are. I don't care who it is. You don't. I mean, he went off like I stole like $100 from him or something. And at that time, I didn't get the urgency of right. which he was speaking.
Right.
And I was like, okay, bro, I won't do it again. I promise, you know? And so we wrapped that up. We grabbed some chicken wings because that's what you're doing in Chicago. Right. And then a couple of days later, he's like, hey, what you doing Saturday? And I'm like, nothing, man. You want to hang out? He's like, yeah, we hanging out. We going to a poetry slam. And I was like, dude, that's what's up. Like, I feel like I need to get back into that vibe. And he was like, cool. So bring some poetry. I was like, why? He's like, bro, because I entered you into the poetry slam. And I was like, dude, I'm not ready for, what are you talking about? And he was like, bro, I paid $25. You better show up. Because if you don't, me and you. And I'm like, dang. Like, when somebody involves money in it, yes. it becomes, like, this whole other thing. $25 don't seem like a lot of money, but for us in our early 20s, that was like, that was, like, VIP status, that's you know what I'm
movies,
saying?
That's a date.
Right? I'm just saying, a date and some snacks afterwards, you know? And so I just remember thinking, man, I don't have anything that's worthy enough of Poetry Slam because I remember the impact that poetry had on me. Mm. And I was like, you know what? Screw it. You know, I'm going to sit down. And I wrote this piece called Celebrate. Mm. And it was more of a cathartic piece. And it was talking about celebrating not only who you are, but the good, the bad, and the ugly of who you are. And that was so huge for me in that moment because at the end of my 6-year relationship, I had no clue of who I was. I had built my life to please who I was with. Like, and I know this sounds super crazy, but I was like at the store. I went to go get, I had a taste for some ice cream. I was like, I want ice cream. And so I go to the freezer section. I put my hands on some Rocky Road ice cream and I freeze and I literally burst into tears. And I know like people who saw me, they're like, what the fuck? Like, you know, what's going on? But I did that because before the relationship, I hated Rocky Road ice cream. But I just got to a point where I was like, you know what? I just want to please who I'm with, so I'll eat it. And it was just like that moment of like, this is not your life anymore. So I poured all of that into this piece. And I'm not even going to say it was a good piece. I just know it felt good. It felt really good. And did it, got to the poetry slam. And these people, I mean, when I tell you they slam it, I'm like, I'm about to sneak out. Like, I'm about to run outside, you know, get my toe run over by a car, bike, something. Cause this, you know, they gonna laugh at me, you know? And so I got up and I remember I got up to that mic and, you know, I had memorized the piece. So I had the paper with me and dude, my hand was shaking so hard. And I couldn't figure out why. I'm like, why am I so freaking nervous? Like I get in front of people. That's not an issue. But it was that moment of like me just tapping into who I was again. And so I did the piece and I'm not going to lie. It wasn't the best, but afterwards, dude, it was just this rush and it felt so good. I was like, yes, this is what I've been missing. I missed it. Like that was my love. I love doing that, you know, and I'm feeling good. And I run to the bathroom because, you know, I was so nervous. I had to pee even before I had to, you know, speak. Sorry for those who are squeamish, but get to the bathroom. I'm in the bathroom and somebody follows me in the bathroom. And I feel somebody standing behind me. And I'm like, bro, like, you can get my number later. Like, why are you trying to?
Not right now.
Not right now. Can I just piss in peace? Like, really? And I remember in my head thinking, okay, I'm going to turn and I'm going to dodge around him. Like, it was this weird thing I made up in my head. And so I turned and he kind of blocked me off. Now I'm like, are we about to throw blows, bro? Because you, you're blocking the exit. Like, you don't do that to me, you know? And I looked closer and, like, his eyes were, like, bloodshot red. They were puffy. And I took a beat. I'm like, bro, you good? And he starts to say through, like, tears, like, almost starting to cry again. He's like, I just want to thank you. Until I heard your piece, I didn't know if I was going to live to see tomorrow. And I just remember in that moment, like, having this thought of, my words have that much power? Like, and I came out. And I'm a big crybaby. So when I came out, you know, I was in tears. My boy Keith happened to be coming around the corner. And he saw me crying. He's like, bro, what happened? Like, what's going on? And I was like, no, nothing happened. And I told him, you know, what the dude said to me. And he was like, Arik, that's why you cannot give up the thing that you love. Because there are lives depending on it. And I just remember that hitting really hard. So that was my introduction to, like, really heavily getting into poetry slamming. And then after that, like, I was on the market, like, slamming. And, you know, the last poetry slam piece that I did was called Shoes. And it was all based on me going to a club. Somebody was really into me. A hater was standing on the side because they were into that person, but that person wasn't showing them no love. So they came up to me and they was like, oh, what kind of shoes are those? Looks like out of style to me. Need to update your shoes. Right, exactly. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm like, bro, like, first of all, we're Black. Second of all, we're Black and gay. Third of all, you got issues with my shoes, and people got issues with just the color of our skin, yeah, and just who we are. And you talking to me about shoes? And I remember the last part of, and to this day, my mom still, that's her favorite piece. Right. Like, how did it end it? So until you know who I am, where I'm from, and what I'm about to do, don't you dare part your motherfucking lips about my motherfucking shoes. And nice. Like, people were like, you know. And that was the last time I slammed. But ever since then, I've just had, like, such a fascination, like, you know, with other slammers. And I think it was also, it was very interesting because around that time when I was going through that whole moment in my life, that's when Jill Scott hit the scene.
Right.
So, you know, when she came to the scene with her poetry and this, and my sister was like, yo, you need to check her out. So it was like just hearing, like, this mainstream artist be so, like, you know, I'm like, okay, Jill, I got you, you know. And so it was just a beautiful time to get into that. So I know that was like a 20-minute explanation of how I got into poetry,
I was going to say, so you were in for 6 years, you got out for three, and then you went back in for another how many years?
No, I was in for 3 years. Okay. By the third year mark, I knew I should have gotten out,
right?
But I didn't.
Oh, okay.
Because I was too afraid. I had built my life on him. Like, literally at one point, he looked at me and he was like, are you thinking about leaving me? And I was like, I am.
Okay.
And his response was, you'll never make it without me. And
I've had that one before.
those are like fighting words, but yeah. I'm not even mad at him. What I'm mad at is that I believed him, which is what kept me around for another 3 years, you know? And, you know, that's why, you know, even the work that I do now, like, when I say I go hard and, like, having people get, like, look, don't let somebody else validate who you are. They're a supplement. They are not the meat and potatoes. They are a scoop of ice cream to your life. Like, you know, nice. Don't. So, I mean, that in a lot of where my heart comes from, real talk comes from life experiences, man, because I've been through some shit. Like, you know, I've been through some tough stuff. But to me, again, I feel this responsibility, especially working with teenagers. And I've always had an affinity for teenagers because I think a lot of people give up on them quick.
Right.
They look at this generation and they're like, oh, they're so apathetic and they're not interested. And I'm like, no, it's not that they're apathetic. They're just tired of putting up with the BS and they're not going to put up a front just to try to make you feel good. They're going to speak their mind and you're upset that they're speaking their mind. Right. You tell them to be unapologetic, but then you don't like when they, you know, talking to you a certain way. So yeah, you know, so, but yeah, that whole relationship piece, man, like it shaped a lot of who I was and who I am today.
So basically from doing poetry and stuff, when was your transference, or what happened to your transference to going to motivational speaker? What made you go into motivational speakers?
You know what? It was never a thought in my mind ever.
Okay.
To be like, I'm going to be this like motivational speaker. As a matter of fact, I almost like hate the term motivational speaker, because when I think motivational speaker, I think very canned.
Yeah.
Your speech is memorized. You're going to do it this way. You're going to say it every single time this way. But at that time, like me just going through growth and personal development, like I was checking out the Les Browns and the Tony Robbins and all of that. So that was just my way of me growing. But never did I have a thought of, oh, I want to do that. Mm. And so I've done a lot of volunteer work with different youth leadership organizations. And one organization in particular, I was volunteering one year. I was a coach, a leadership coach for the students. I had about 12 students. And so it's a weekend event. They show, basically the event started 8 o'clock in the morning on Friday and they didn't leave until like 12 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday. So, but some of these kids, it was like an Illinois-wide event. So some of these kids were like in the car like 3 o'clock in the morning, like getting there so they could be in time for registration. So I get the kids and some of them are like, why am I even here right now? My parents forced me, blah, blah, blah. And so we sit down for the opening keynote speaker. Sitting there and I'm like, yeah, we about to do this. This keynote, the speaker, he got up. And just to kind of give you a feel of the stuff he was saying, he was like, in life, and he's literally talking like this. He's like, in life, you have to have goals. I have goals. Do you have goals? And I'm like, bro, I'm about to get up on the stage and beat you, because first of all, it's 8 o'clock in the morning. I got 12 kids to sit in here. That's like, how am I about to bounce up out of here? Like, if y'all talking to me like that, you know, and I remember that day I was working hard to like convince the kids, like, this is a good place to be. They're like, that speaker though, like, why y'all do that to us? Like, y'all hate us. Like, and then that Sunday, the closing keynote speaker, never forget it. He's out of Chicago as well. Maui Askadon, Ethiopian refugee. And actually, this is like back in the day when Oprah used to have her book club.
Yeah.
So he had done a book called of Beatles. I have to look it up. But Maui Askadon. And so they're reading like his introduction. I'm like, bro, this dude is like legit. Like, right. He got okay from Oprah, like, you're next to Jesus right now, you know. And so I remember like hearing all of that, and then he got on stage and he did his thing, and I just remember he was so real, he was so open, he was so vulnerable, man. Just hearing him tell his story about what he went through. Out of an hour-long speech, I would think like 45 minutes of that speech, like just tears kept rolling down my face. Because not only was I moved by his story, but I felt like in that moment, something was like, and this is what you're supposed to be doing in your life. And I just remember thinking, what? Like, huh? But it was so real. And after the conference, I ran up to him. I felt like a groupie of Beyonce or something. I ran up to him and I was like, yo, like, I know you don't know me. I don't know you like that, but I want to do what you do. And he's like, okay. So meet me in my office Tuesday, 12 o'clock. I was like, cool. Tuesday comes around, 11:50. I'm like at his office knocking on the door, and he opens the door and he almost has this shocked look on his face. And he was like, oh, you came. And I was like, yeah.
You told me.
Right. I'm like, you said 12 o'clock. Do you need a couple of minutes? I understand I'm a few minutes early, but you know. And he goes on to tell me, he's like, you know what? I'm going to be real. I've been doing this for so many years, and I've had so many people walk up to me and say, I want to do what you do. And I extend the same offer, and they never take me up on it.
Mm.
And So for me, and then even for those who are listening right now, like when that opportunity is presented to you, take it. Right. Like even if you don't know what the hell you're doing, take it. Because I didn't know what I knew I could be entertaining in front of people. Right. I knew I was good at cracking decent jokes. I knew like poetry slamming, I could do that, but right. It wasn't speaking per se. And so we sat down in his office for about 2 hours. He took an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. He wrote my name in the middle of it. He circled it and he said, "Now this is what your career is going to look like." And he literally drew out my career path. And I literally took that career path. And to this day, I still have that sheet of paper.
So basically like clustered it out and then mm-hmm. showed you which ways to go.
Yeah. So. He's like, first of all, you want to come up with like, what are you going to talk about? Why is it important to hear you? Then you want to start working on your book. And I'm like, a book, bro? Like, I wouldn't even, like, that was never, but when I tell you, he just laid it out so clearly and there was like this level of conviction behind it. I was like, okay, you know, you own Oprah's list. I want to get there one day. Like, okay, I'm going to do what you say do. So I started that whole journey. And then it was a year later at the exact same conference, they asked me to come back and be a coach. And it didn't, my schedule didn't work out for me to be there for the entire weekend. I said, but have you all figured out your opening keynote speaker yet? And they're like, oh, we're still working on it. I said, so I know a lot about this conference. I know what the kids go through. Like, I would love to be the opening keynote speaker. And Kristen, she was a board chair at the time. And she's like, all right, well, I'll take it to the board and we'll see what they say. And I'm thinking to myself, Kristen, you know me, girl. Why is you putting me through this? Like, and it was like 3 days. And every time my phone rang, I'm like looking at the phone, like, is it her? And so she finally calls me back and she's like, so I talked with the board and just want to let you know, after some discussion, they decided that it would be a perfect fit for you to come. I'm like, Kristen, why are you doing that to me? Like, I feel like you're about to set me up, you know? And that was back in 2005. And I delivered my first speech and it was called Don't Be Scared. And at the time, that was back in the day when like, instead of saying scared, people said scared. Don't be scared.
Don't be to destroy your box. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when I'm talking about your box, I need you to understand, I am not talking about your comfort zone. I'm talking about that one thing in that life that happened that when it happened, it literally shut you down.
So I just took that and ran with it, you know what I'm saying? And that was in 2005. And ever since then, every year in June, it's usually the second or third weekend, I always go back and volunteer my time to that organization because they gave me my first opportunity to speak. So that's my way of continuing to pour into them. So, yeah, and it's been history since then, man. Yeah.
So you've had Don't Be Scared, and then also you have Ripple Effect.
Yeah.
So just give us a premise of what Because of Don't Be Scared. What? Mm-hmm. Give me a little premise of what Don't
so,
Be Scared about.
Don't Be Scared. That became my number. Right, exactly. And I literally imagine elders in the audience, me forcing them to say skirt, and they looking at me like, we're going to, you have just set our race back like 100 years. But Don't Be Scared. Actually, when I originally did the speech, it was really a speech for students who were coming into that particular weekend, and it's like, don't be scared to be yourself. Don't be scared to have fun. So it was kind of surface level stuff, right? And I kind of kept that surface level for like several years, actually. I'm not even gonna lie. And it wasn't like I was speaking all the time. It was like a part-time thing. So I spoke maybe like once a month. And if I spoke once a month, that was like a roll. Like I was on a roll. And it was 1 year where I was invited, and this is like when I was actually paid. Like I was paid to come speak at this school. Nice. So I'm legit now. Yeah. Like you cut me a check instead of giving me hot dogs. I'm like this is, you know? And so I'm doing my speech. It was at a freshman orientation. Okay. Mind you, they weren't even freshmen yet. They were eighth graders coming to get an orientation for when they became freshmen. So technically, they're not even freshmen yet. I'm doing my speech. I'm doing my thing. And I'm trying to be like Tony Robbins. I'm trying to be like Les Brown. I'm trying to be like everybody else. And literally, these kids start to boo me. They're like, boo, get off the stage. And I'm like, and at first I was like, okay, this is a joke. Like, you know, but like the audience got so rowdy and they were like, boo, you suck, and this, that, and the other. And honestly, I was about to walk off that stage, give them their check back and say, you know what? I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But I don't like to back down. Okay. So what I did was I sat at the edge of the stage and I was like, look, y'all, I get it. Y'all not feeling me. I totally get it. You know, but this is why I want y'all to hear what I'm saying. And for the first time, unscripted, nothing planned, I told the story of growing up with my mom being a single parent and how bad I wanted my dad to be in my life. And he wasn't in my life for a big part of my life, and how that had a huge effect on me in school and this and the other. And at one point, it was just like, I just started talking. Like, it was like how you and I are sitting across right. from each other talking. It was just like, I just opened up. It wasn't scripted. It was none of that. And it went from like this rowdy ass audience to it being like pin drop silent. And I remember my client standing in the back, and she has this like baffled look on her face. Like, how did you just do that? And even for me, I didn't realize what was happening.
Right.
When I was done with the speech, like about a good 50, 60 kids lined up to talk to me afterwards. They're like, man, your story about your dad, man, like I'm dealing with that right now. And I don't know how much, you know, I'm scared of high school. So they became human right. in that moment. And I remember walking away. I got in my car. I was like, what just happened? Like, it went from like the first 20, 30 minutes, them being rowdy, not listening to me, kids throwing paper at each other and stuff like that. To this audience that was totally engaged.
Yeah.
And I sat down and I dissected that. I went into like analyzer mode and I'm just processing it in my head. And so I was like, well, it switched when I started talking about my dad. Huh. Next time I went to go do a speech, used some of the same stuff, but then told the story about my dad. Same reaction. And I'm like,
I go back to eating, and all of a sudden, the macaroni and cheese doesn't taste the same. The ham on the bone, even my grandmama's homemade cornbread doesn't taste right, because I have this burning question in the back of my head. And before I realize it, I get so upset, I look up and I shout out, where's my dad? My grandmother, she stops. She slowly pushes away from the table. She gets up. She walks over to me. She grabs my hand. She pulls me into the kitchen. She sits me down, and she picks up the phone. And next thing you know, I hear my grandmother say, I don't care where you are. Get here now.
These kids are starving for real stories. Like, they're not, they don't want the rah-rah, be go be great and, right. you know, have fun. They're looking for, look, this is what I went through and this is who I am today. And so I had no clue that me being that raw and that authentic was so needed for the students. And to this day, I still tell the story about my dad. So for Don't Be Scared. So what that evolved into is Don't Be Scared to Destroy Your Box. And when I talk about your box, I talk about the limitations, whether it's limitations that other people put on you
right.
or the limitations that you put on yourself. Right. And I mainly speak to the limitations that we put on ourselves, you know,
okay.
because we can hide it very good. We yeah. know how to show up, put a smile on our face, act like everything is okay. But when we're by ourselves, like, we're beating up on ourselves. We're saying we're not good enough. We're comparing ourselves to other people.
Right.
And so it's that box that I talk about. And for me, my box of not feeling wanted, not being loved, if my own dad didn't want me, why would somebody else want me? So this whole self-worth conversation, that had become my box after dealing with the situation with my dad. And so I talk about how that box had just really ran the show for a lot of my life, which is why I was in a very unhealthy relationship, because I was depending on him to dictate my self-worth.
Right.
And I didn't have enough self-worth for myself, which is why I stayed as long as I did. And so, you know, doing the work, going through, and I talk about like the three steps of destroying the box. Number one, acknowledge that there is a box. A lot of us walking around, we don't acknowledge what has happened. But what people fail to realize is when you're like acting like it's not there, it shows up in different ways. Like, it may show up in you having a conversation and somebody may say bubblegum, and it might trigger you, and you like going off on, and you're like, why did I snap off about bubblegum? Like, what was it about that? Oh, but you realize that, you know, one day your uncle said you look like a little sissy chewing on that bubblegum, you know, and we don't realize that those things, they're there.
Right.
And so it's number one, become aware of it. Number two, forgive the person that had you create that box. A lot of times we end up in situations because someone either said or did something to us that had us retreat into that box, you know? So for me, it was like, you know, I I had a conversation with my dad, and I remember I was like bawling. I was sitting in his lap, and I'm like, you know, why don't you want me? Why don't you love me? And his response to me was, I'm sorry, son, I'm just too busy. And I just remember thinking, man, but he said that, but his action spoke differently. I always saw him with a different woman. Mm. He was always going out on a date and this and the other. One time he tried to take me out with him on a date, and I was like upset. But you don't have time. Right. No, you just don't want to have time for me. Mm. So I took that, and that built like this box. So I finally forgave him about that. And I was like 23 when I forgave him, which what's very interesting is 23 is right not too long before I ended that other relationship.
Oh, okay.
So
kind of, it's just all kind of like full circle.
Yeah.
But you did say about when you're, because I know of a couple of stories about mm-hmm. your father and stuff, but you did point out one of the stories was when you sat with him, but tell about the part about how that happened. When your grandmother, and it was at what kind of...
Yeah, so back then growing up, my grandmother, his mother, it was a thing of mine to always go over there on Sundays. Like that was my way of being connected to that side of the family.
Right.
And so this particular Sunday, dad was going to be there. Mm. Like, I'm like, yes, I get to see my dad. You know, it might be for 10, 15 minutes, but I get to be with dad, you know. And I love my grandparents, like, but I just wanted to see my dad, you know. And so we're sitting at the table, we're eating, you know, me and my funny looking sister. She was funny looking back then. Like, she had this snaggletooth thing going on. I didn't know if I should, like, hug her or call the police. I was conflicted. She's beautiful now. Beautiful family, but let me tell you.
Whew. She hears this, he meant that.
She knows. This is why I keep my distance from her. Because she'll shank me. So we're sitting at the table. We're eating. And it's like me, my sister, my mom, my grandparents, and two aunts. And there's a space open at the table.
Right.
And I knew that was the space set for my dad.
Right.
And so just kind of out of the blue, I'm like, where's my dad? And my grandmother, she gives me this look as if to say, we're not going to have that conversation now. She never says a word. She just gives me that look, and she puts her head back down. She continues to eat. No one ever answers me. And so that was the cue, like, all right, I'm in a child's place. Stay in place. Let me eat. And so I go back to eating, and, like, literally it's hard for me to eat because I feel – like, I feel like I'm shaking on the inside. Like, there's just something. To this day, I still can't explain that. And even just to kind of feel that feeling is just hard for me right now.
Right.
But I just remember, like, I was shaking. And it got to a point I couldn't deal with the shakes anymore. And I just blurted out at the table and I screamed out. I'm like, where's my dad? You know, and my grandmother, she saw me. She puts her silverware down. She pushes away from the table. She gets me. She takes me into the kitchen. She picks up the phone. And the next thing you know, I hear her saying, you know, I don't care where you are. Get here now. And an hour later, that's when I'm sitting downstairs in the den crying and my dad slaps saying, why don't you want me? Why don't you love me? So just all of that led up to that moment, you know. And it's very interesting because when he said, I'm too busy, I didn't even realize it then, but in that moment, I made up my mind. I was like, okay, I don't have a dad anymore.
Mm.
Like, I was done. I'm like, you won't even spend time with me? Okay, cool. So we gonna do this.
So you said one is identify the box. Two is?
Acknowledge the box.
Acknowledge the box.
Forgive the person that had you create that box.
So you acknowledge the box. You've seen the box. But what was the point that you basically saw that you had to forgive?
Oh, this is some good stuff, man.
Because I know you basically had to deal with that I forgot to tell you people. My man here, he was going to be on Living Color.
In Living Color.
So,
yeah.
So,
thanks for throwing that in my face. So I had taken like all that energy, like I don't have a dad, this and the other, and that's when I started investing in my writing, my playwriting, poetry slamming. I went to Columbia College of Chicago, which is an amazing performing arts school. And so we were always like hear like about the different auditions coming through Chicago. And so one of those auditions, what actually happened to be at Oprah Studios, was In Living Color.
Nice.
Went to that audition, rocked it out. And then it's like, I got a call back. It was like for one of the final auditions. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, grandma, I'm going to buy you a new washer washer and dryer. You know, I got you. I had plans. I was ready, man. I was like ready to go. And the day of my audition, my dad and I, we talked every once in a while, but we didn't like talk. You know what I'm saying? As a matter of fact, when we talked, it was like, okay, what do you want? I was very much like that. And so he calls me out the blue, you know, and he's like, hey, I just want to wish you luck on your audition today. First of all, I'm thinking, how did you find out? You know, and then I realized I have a nosy grandmother. So she told him, and I'm like, all right, thanks. And I was done with the conversation. And I go to hang up the phone, and I hear him in the back. He's like, whoa, wait, hold on. And I'm like, what? He says, why? I'm like, why what? He then goes on to say, why won't you let me back in? And I remember that same shaking feeling that I had when I was a little boy. Right. It showed up again, but it was like on level infinity at this point. And I lost it. I went off on, I was screaming. I was like, man, well, I wanted you. You didn't have time for me. But now all of a sudden you got a conscience. Now you just want to walk back up in my life. Man, push on with that. Like, I was pissed.
Right.
I was so angry, I headed to my audition, and that anger, that poison, didn't shake. And I ended up having one of the worst auditions of my life because I was so triggered by that moment. And, the audition was so bad, I literally turned to the people in the room and I said, I apologize for wasting your time. Like, it was bad. Like, through. I just, embarrassing ain't even the word. And so I walked out of there and I just remember being stunned. Have you ever had a moment where you've been like, something has happened, you're like so numb to what just, you're like, what just happened, you know? And I'm thinking to myself, what happened? Like, I just had this huge opportunity in front of me and I just screwed it up. Like, not little bit, like, I really screwed it up.
Yeah.
And that caused me to do some self-reflection. And I realized the very thing that had me even get into that space is because I was holding on to a grudge against my dad. Mm. So anything that looked like him trying to be nice to me or anything like that, it set me off. Like, you got to understand, like, growing up, and I'll give credit where credit is due. Okay. So that situation with my dad, when I sat in his lap, I was in the den with him. I was about 9 years old when that happened. By the time I'm 10, 11, 12, 13, he has an epiphany, like, you know, this is my son. I can't leave him hanging. And so he would start showing up at, like, different events because I was always in a play or in a concert. And he'd show up, hello, son, how are you? And I was just like, hello, Michael, how are you? Like, I didn't even acknowledge him as my dad. So I was spending so much time holding on to this poison of unforgiveness. And I realized in so many ways, I'm like, the only reason why I lost it like that is because I'm too busy trying to hold on to a grudge against him. And, you know, when I work with kids all the time, I'm like, look, if you hold on to a grudge longer than 5 minutes, you have held on way too long.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, like, you have a choice in the matter. And I've even had some kids, like, dude, like, straight up challenge me on that.
Okay.
Like, you know, I think it was in Louisiana, speaking at the school, and it was this one girl, she was like all into the speech, and then I told the dad story and I was like, you know, you can't hold on to a grudge, you have to forgive. And she's like her whole face changed. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, did I say something wrong?
Yeah.
And afterwards she was like, I loved everything you said except for the forgiveness. And I was like, okay, well, why? And she's like, I just don't believe that I could forgive that person. And I was like, well, I said, I hear you. I said, but here's what you have to understand. Like, you're going to spend so much energy holding on to that grudge, that unforgiveness, that you're not going to be able to see anything else.
Right.
And I was like, so ultimately it's your choice. And then she starts getting emotional and she's like, but I can't. And I'm like, talk to me, what's going on? She goes on to tell me, bro, that she saw her mother and her sister murdered by her stepfather.
Oh.
And the stepfather tried to kill her.
Right.
And she was able to get out of the situation. And I just remember thinking exactly what you said, like, damn. Like, but I told her, I was like, look, I get it. I totally understand why you would find it hard to forgive. I said, and here's what I want you to understand. I'm not saying you have to forgive him for what he did. What he did is unexcusable.
Right.
You know, he took two very close people out of your life, like unexcusable. But if you're going to move on with your life, you have to say, you know what? I forgive you because I just need to forgive you.
Right.
I'm not saying what you did was right or anything like that. We think that there's this way of us like, oh, I'm not going to forgive you. I'll be better off not forgiving you.
Right.
But that is the worst poison ever, bro, because it feeds like we can't even be around that person. We can't think about that person without getting upset, frustrated, triggered, whatever that was. And that was my whole life with my dad.
Yeah.
Like it even got to a point where like around Christmases and stuff like that, like he'd buy me all these gifts and I'd be like, thanks, bro, whatever. Like it was just, I didn't care because I'm like, shh.
That concludes part one of our two-part interview. For more information, please go to linktr.ee/iambiczine. IAMBICZINE. Thank you.